It's a brand new and special Best Podcast in Baseball. I talk with Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City and host of the podcast Black Diamonds. We discuss one of the first dynasties in St. Louis baseball history, the role the Negro Leagues played in popularizing not just baseball in St. Louis, but a particular style of baseball in St. Louis. And we dive deep into his plans for the museum and the pitch for the future, which could see an elaborate expansion and ever more access to greater stories that we all should hear, we all should be eager to tell. That's all ahead in a brand new Best Podcast in Baseball. Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Best Podcast in Baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and it is my great honor, thrill, all of it, to welcome Bob Kendrick to the podcast. He's the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, just one of the best guys when it comes to talking about baseball history, and a tremendous representative both of our state, but also of the game that we love. Bob, it's great to see you, to talk with you. I didn't get a chance to say hello when I saw you last, because we were there for a tour of the museum with our mutual friend Vahe Gregorian, and I had to bolt midway through. So thank you very much for joining me here.
No, Derek, it's my pleasure, man. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I want to start by asking you, okay, so here in St. Louis, it's the centennial celebration of the Cardinals' first World Series championship in 1926. Roger Hornsby applies a tag to Babe Ruth, who was trying to steal second base. It ends the game, and the Cardinals get the first of what has now become 11 World Series championships, their claim to fame in the National League. But at the same time, part of the growth of baseball in this city and the strengthening of the roots of baseball in the city was another dynasty developing. Can you tell us more about the St. Louis Stars and kind of their role in 1920s baseball?
Yeah, no, St. Louis, Derek, has tremendously rich Black baseball history. And it actually dates back to the formation of the Negro Leagues, as you know, which were established here in Kansas City in 1920. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the original eight Negro League franchises was then the St. Louis Giants. And then the St. Louis Giants would morph into the more popular and better known St. Louis Stars. But I remind folks, in 1921, the legendary Oscar Charleston, mm-hmm. who was one of the early superstars of the Negro Leagues. Now, the Negro Leagues had a bunch of stars, but when we talk superstars, Charleston and the great Bullet Rogan were superstars of Rube Foster's Negro National League when it was established in 1920. Well, in 1921, as a member then of the St. Louis Giants, Oscar Charleston had one of the greatest single seasons, not in Black baseball history, but in baseball history, when he led the Negro Leagues in home runs, triples, doubles, stolen bases, and batting average in the same season with those St. Louis Giants. And then about a year later, the St. Louis Giants would then become the St. Louis Stars. And you're right. You cannot tell the story of St. Louis baseball history without talking about the Negro Leagues and the great St. Louis Stars, because we're talking about some of the greatest ball players to ever play in the great city of St. Louis. When we talk about the likes of Cool Papa Bell, Willie El Diablo Wells, mm-hmm. the great Mule Suttles. And folks, if you don't and hadn't heard the name Mule Suttles, mm-hmm. look him up, because Mule Suttles was one of the great power hitters in this game. And you're not going to believe this, but it's true. He swung a 50-ounce bat.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, 50-ounce. Now, if your nickname is Mule, well, you got to be strong and maybe a little stubborn too. But when he would come to the plate, the fans there in St. Louis and wherever he played would start yelling, "Kick Mule, kick," because really? They knew he was going to do something special. And so the Stars were one of the few Negro League teams that actually had their own ballpark. They mm-hmm. were able to build Stars Park. And so, they had a great run in the Negro Leagues, having won league titles in 31, 1930 and 1928.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they had a great run there in St. Louis.
Yeah, it's neat here because one of the things, the Stars Field, you can visit. It's on Harris Stowe campus there in the city. And one of the real cool things, my son went to a public high school here in St. Louis. And when they played baseball, they would play baseball on that field.
Yeah.
And his home, his school's home field was technically Cool Papa Bell Field, which is
cool. That's pretty,
which is
that's
really pretty cool. Yeah, that's right. That's pretty cool. Yeah. The lights did not go out before the players left the field. So, yeah, they did not go out before the switch was flipped. They stayed on there. It was a great play. You have, I mean, there's a lot of representation of St. Louis there in the museum in Kansas City. It's only a short drive. It's a great place to visit. You'd spend an hour just walking around the field with the different and kind of imagining what the game was like. But you have a lot of like St. Louis touches there, St. Louis items.
Oh, no, there's no question. And I, you know, I can't help but go back to my dear friend, and I miss him dearly, the late, great Lou Brock. And Derek, when Lou came over to St. Louis, as you know, in one of the worst trades in baseball history, when the Cubs traded him for a hurt arm pitcher named Ernie Broglio. And of course, Buck O'Neill was the last guy to sign off on that trade that sent Lou over to St. Louis. And Buck said every time he went to then Busch Stadium, said the St. Louis Cardinal fans would give him a standing ovation for the gift that just kept on giving. Well, Lou says when he first arrived in St. Louis, one of the first people to reach out to him was the late, great Cool Papa Bell. Now, Lou would say, I knew who Cool Papa Bell was, but I didn't know Cool Papa Bell knew who I was. And I think Buck had reached out to Cool Papa and said, hey, you keep an eye on this young man. And so they set up a meeting, and Lou and Cool became great friends. And Lou would say that Cool would come in and give him tips on base running and base stealing that he said he had never heard before. And he would say, Cool Papa, I never saw this in the book. Cool said, Lou, this ain't in the book. You know, that is how great. And we talk about the speed of Cool Papa.
Mm-hmm.
His base running ability was likely the best this game has ever seen. Buck O'Neill would say that he had the uncanny ability to cut the bag on the inside at such a severe angle that he could literally smack the bag with his hand and Derek not fall over. Now, some things we just have to accept as God-given. And the good Lord gave Cool Papa Bell some wheels. And as fate would have it, he came to the St. Louis Stars, as you know, as a pitcher. And he hurt his arm. He hurt his arm. And that's when they moved him to the outfield. And that's when the legend of Cool Papa Bell actually sprung up, because he was using that blazing speed to track down everything in the outfield. Didn't have a great throwing arm because he had hurt his arm, but he could cover so much ground, he could play so shallow, and he had a quick release, which made him one of the greatest defensive outfielders this sport has ever seen. And we mentioned Willie Wells.
Mm-hmm.
Cardinal fans, you should know who Willie Wells is, because Willie Wells was Ozzie Smith before there ever was an Ozzie Smith. Yeah, I had Oz on my podcast, Black Diamonds, talking about Willie Wells. And it's amazing that St. Louis is the home of two of the greatest, most acrobatic shortstops in baseball history. But Willie Wells, Derek, was a power-hitting shortstop who made those same kind of acrobatic plays that we've grown and known and fallen in love with the great Ozzie Smith. Willie Wells was doing that in the 20s and 30s, and he was absolutely amazing. And as I was mentioning, his nickname was El Diablo, the devil, because he could dig it out of the dirt. Yeah, great hands, quick release, but like I said, a power-hitting shortstop. So yeah, you're right. St. Louis is well represented in this museum, and we're very proud of the heritage of Black baseball that is there in the city of St. Louis.
I really like, I'm glad you brought up Wells and kind of gave that description. Cause you of course beat me to the, what I wanted to bring up is the notion that like the Stars were playing this style of game of speed and defense. And they did have hitters. I mean, they had a fearsome lineup, but they were playing this style of speed and defense that kind of became synonymous with St. Louis all the way in through Whitey ball. It was an entertaining game. There was a time in St. Louis when there were a handful of professional teams playing and they had support, you know, the Federal League, Negro League, National League, American League. You had all these ballparks going, you know, Union, I think at one point in time, you had a lot of interest in baseball. You've heard the stories from Buck. You've talked to Lou and everything like that. I know how much you cherish history. And that goes for the city on the other side of the state too. How do you think that all kind of came together, that entertaining brand of baseball, to kind of really fortify what we now know is like a real baseball city?
Yeah, no. It was something that I think from its origins, when Rube Foster started the Negro Leagues in 1920, that was the brand of baseball that he preached. Yeah, no, Rube was known to find his ball players. At the turn of the 1900s, as much as $5 if they were tagged out standing up. Oh, no, you were supposed to slide.
Okay.
He would draw a circle down the first baseline and a circle down the third baseline. And if every one of his players, Derek, couldn't drop a bunt inside that circle, he would find them. And that was a style of play that became signature Negro Leagues baseball. So fast, aggressive, daring. They would bunt their way on. Then they're going to steal second. They're going to steal third. And like I oftentimes say, if you're not too smart, they were stealing home. And that is the style of play that drew Black and white fans who sat side by side during an era when doing something socially together. Negro Leagues baseball brought the two races together because Major League Baseball fans were seeing a style of play that they weren't accustomed to see. And it was a wildly more entertaining brand. You know, back then, Major League Baseball was essentially a base-to-base kind of game. So, you know, the guy got on base, then you move him over to second, and then the big hitters came up, and they drove him in. Nothing wrong with that. But as Buck O'Neill would say, when you went to a Negro Leagues game, and this was epitomized there in St. Louis, you couldn't go to the concession stand because you might miss something that you ain't never seen before. And that's what the Stars brought to baseball there and why they were so popular there in St. Louis. And they should be remembered in a city that its baseball history is as rich as any. The St. Louis Stars should absolutely be remembered for what they gave St. Louis as well.
I picked up some St. Louis Star stickers when I visited the museum. I got a chance to see the Rube Foster statue that you have. And I love how the style of play, like they're statues, they're not moving, but that field that you have there with the great players at every position, it's very kinetic. It feels, like they're moving.
Yeah, no, you feel their spirits when you walk out on that field. And as I remind folks, it's a triumphant spirit. It's not a sad story. And I know that most baseball fans, when they come here, think that they're going to be introduced to a very sad, somber kind of story. Because obviously, Derek, we know that this story is anchored against the ugliness of American segregation, which certainly was a horrible chapter in this country's history. But the story as we present it is what emerged out of segregation. This wonderful story of triumph and conquest. And so when you walk out on that field, And I I'm biased, but I think the Field of Legends at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum is one of the most amazing displays in any museum anywhere in the world. It features 10 life-size bronze sculptures of Negro League greats, and they represent the first group of Negro Leaguers to be inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. So that's how our All-Star team was chosen. And as you remember, on the outside looking in, is the late, great Buck O'Neill, who's managing this great All-Star team. And folks, we basically segregate you from the field. So you can always see the field, but you can't really get to it until you learn their story. And as oftentimes,
one of the fans.
By the time you've bear witness to everything that they had to endure to play baseball in this country, then we allow you to take the field. But I can tell you, it is a triumphant feeling when you walk out on those on that field and you walk up and stand next to those statues and take your pictures with the statues. I got a funny feeling when the dust settles, they start throwing the ball around the horn in the contest place.
Just the way you're describing that, I got carried away because I was like, you know, there's so much to learn. And you do walk through the turnstiles there. You get to stand beside Buck O'Neill. You look at the Field of Legends through the wire fence the first time you get to see him. And I'm just struck by how much, I mean, it's just, it's a museum that is very much larger on the inside. And I know a big goal for you right now is to make it larger in reality.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the pitch for the future goal and what you envision as not just a museum, but a campus there at 18th and Vine?
Yeah, no, we're dreaming big again. You know, this museum started, Derek, in a little one-room office in 1990. Not much bigger than this office that I'm in right now. And all it had was a conference room table and guys like the late, great Buck O'Neill and other local Negro Leaguers who were still with us at that time. Sad to say, they've all passed on. All those guys who were here in Kansas City who were part of the early formation of this museum, they've all passed on. They literally took turns paying the monthly rent to keep that little office open. And as I like to say, with it, our hopes and dreams of someday building a facility that would pay rightful tribute to not just one of the greatest chapters in baseball history, but what now thousands upon thousands each and every year discover, one of the greatest chapters in American history. But when you move from a one-room office to our current home, which is now about 10,000 square feet of space, you feel like you've got a lot of space. Matter of fact, you're worried about how you're going to fill it all up. Mm-hmm. Well, we move beyond filling it up, and we're now busting from the seams. And so it has dictated a need for now us to expand. It also, I think, is a great indicator of the popularity of the story that we preserve. Negro Leagues history is as hot today as it has ever been. And I do think some of the milestones that we've seen in and around Negro Leagues history, the entering of the stats of the Negro Leagues into the record books of Major League Baseball, the positioning of the Negro Leagues into the video game, MLB, the show, the big national, international salute to the Negro Leagues game that was held at Rickwood Field. All these things have kind of helped elevate the awareness. The museum has been front and center in making those things happen. And so if we were to attain a large collection, we'd have no place to display it. We needed room to breathe. We needed room to grow. Thus, we recently announced plan to build a brand new 30,000+ square foot Negro Leagues baseball museum that is going to be part, as you mentioned, of a Negro Leagues campus, because the new museum will be built attached to the former Paseo YMCA, where the Leagues were established in 1920 by Andrew Rube Foster. That building is being renovated and going to be converted into an education and research center in memory of the late, great Buck O'Neill. And then the museum, new museum, will be built adjacent to that historic landmark. And we've also announced our plans in partnership with a developer here in Kansas City to build a Marriott tribute hotel that is aptly going to be called The Pennant, that is going to be built into the new Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So you can see why I'm so excited. Yeah. You know, about this campus, which will become the gateway into historic 18th and Vine and an international headquarters for both Black baseball and social history. But as I like to say, I am as excited as you could possibly be about having to raise about $50 million.
Yeah, that is quite well. How can folks help? What are you doing? What are some things that people can do?
If they are so inclined, please visit our website at www.nlbm.com and look for their Legacy Plays On, and it'll take you to our landing page. And I know a lot of times, Derek, when people hear about these kinds of sizable capital efforts, well, they feel like, well, you're only looking for large gifts. Well, we are looking for large gifts, but if we can get a lot of people to donate a little bit of money, it just closes that gap. Or as I think about my friend Buck O'Neill, when I say literally every buck counts. No. There's no small amount. Any amount helps us get closer to our goal of building this new Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And, you know, it's a daunting task, but I have no doubt that we will get it done. The question is, how quickly can we get it done? And I'd like to see this done before Kansas City gets a new Royal Stadium, which is only going to be about 2 miles away from where the new museum is going to be built. Wow. And there's a great prospect of a streetcar line, the first east-west streetcar line, coming to 18th and Vine in conjunction with this. So in many ways, the stars are kind of aligning for this museum. And so it also, it puts a little bit of additional pressure to try and get this done, you know, as swiftly as we possibly can.
That'd be magic for folks to be able to stay at that hotel.
Absolutely.
And take a streetcar to the ball game. That'd just be, it'd be like from another time, like from a snow globe.
Absolutely.
Wow. The way you describe that campus, you know, Bob, I'm really struck by the blend of, there's the tourist factor. There's that draw. And then there's the education factor.
Exactly.
Like that, the building that you're describing and sort of some of the things that you want involved in it, what are the academic pursuits that you want to also be able to kind of foster and grow there? You
know, we look at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, Derek, as being one of the nation's preeminent social justice, civil rights institutions. And so the reason that we wanted to save the Paseo YMCA and essentially convert it into an education and research center in memory of the late, great Buck O'Neill was so that we could kind of create this kind of centralized place where we could share the writings and oral histories, the access to the Black papers that were the primary voice of the Negro League, so that more folks could actually come in and learn in a deeper capacity beyond just the tourist aspect of walking through a great museum. But for those who are maybe inclined to want to learn more and go in depth, we wanted to have this one-stop shop where they could do this, this central repository for both Negro Leagues and social history. And that's what we have an opportunity to do with this complex while also creating a dynamic cultural institution that will be one of, because it already is one of the preeminent cultural institutions in our nation. And so certainly from a tourist standpoint, we anticipate seeing even more, but what it gives us is the wherewithal and the ability to manage and handle more people. The current museum, while it is absolutely gorgeous, it was never set up to have a lot of people in it at any one period of time.
Yeah,
some of the confines get a little tight in the space. And so this gives us additional room to breathe so that we can handle an even larger audience base. But we also wanted to have a place where people who, again, wanted to dive deeper. You know, from a child writing his first paper on Jackie Robinson to someone wanting to maybe write their thesis on the economic impact of the Negro Leagues. You know, we wanted to provide that kind of place. And we feel like we're doing that by, number one, saving the Paseo YMCA. That building had been abandoned for years. Matter of fact, it had not operated since the early 1970s. And so it had been boarded up. It had been abandoned. It was harboring illicit activity. Sad to say, vagrants were living in that building until we took ownership and started to clean it up. And as you know, so oftentimes in this country, we have a tendency to knock these buildings down.
Mm-hmm.
And that was eventually going to happen with that YMCA building. It was either going to be knocked down or fall down until we took ownership of it and started to stabilize it and been diligently renovating that building ever since. And I'm excited to remember Buck in this fashion because the educational aspect of the Negro Leagues was something that he always wanted to tout.
There's that actual asphalt connection that will be there between this campus and the modern game, between, you know, the museum and the new Royal Stadium that, you know, we hope all comes together. You touched on it too, that there's these growing kind of connections between the modern game through the video game, through the Rick Wood thing that is bringing the Negro Leagues right in front of the modern fan. That, you know, you watch the special event with the Giants and the Cardinals playing in Birmingham, which was fantastic. Just such a cool thing. I didn't get to attend because I was at something with my son. But I watched it multiple times. I've watched the replay of it multiple times. I don't know how many non-World Series, non-All-Star games to say that you'd watch multiple times, but it was so cool to watch. I've also had the fortune of visiting Rickwood multiple times. Got to take my son there and run the bases, which was really neat. So, but, you know, there's all these elements now that appear to be strengthening the modern game's bond with the Negro Leagues. The stats are part of that. Do you feel that as well?
Oh, no question about it. And really, Derek, that's kind of been our mindset from the onset, was how do we give Negro Leagues history a mainstream voice? Because I've always believed that that wasn't really a time that people didn't want to know about the Negro Leagues. Derek, they just had no way to know about the Negro Leagues. It's not in the pages of American history books. And as my late mother would say, you don't know what you don't know. And so that's been part of the mission of this museum, is how do we elevate the awareness and interest in the subject matter so that it could gain a mainstream voice. The things that we both mentioned have certainly aided in doing that. And so whether it was the national podcast that I do with my friends over at SiriusXM Radio called Black Diamonds, now over 100 episodes that we've done now, and that led to Sony, who some of the game developers there at Sony were big fans of the Black Diamonds podcast. So they're hearing me tell stories about the Negro.
Yeah, love it.
And then that led them to reach out to me about the possibility of including the Negro Leagues into the video game MLB The Show. As you know, the biggest baseball video game in the world. And I knew we were doing something special. But I'll be honest, man, I think I was probably a little naive about just how big the gaming platform really is. And so people had always hit me up on social media. Do you think the Negro Leagues would ever be in the video game? We would love to see the Negro Leagues in the video game. Well, Sony created that pathway. And when they reached out to me about this, we started having conversations. The more conversations we had, the more interested they became. And the next thing I know, we've got a full-fledged production crew here at the museum. And they sat down, turned the cameras on, and told me to start telling stories. Well, they were very smart about how they did this. Instead of just randomly throwing Negro League players in the game with random stats, they created a mode called Storylines. And that's where I come in, because I'm now telling stories. So folks, yeah, I know, I never dreamt that I'd be in a video game. Yeah, I saw myself doing a lot of things, but I never dreamt I'd be in a video game. And that video game has turned me into a household name in the gaming community. Because what it has done has been this portal. It opened up to Negro Leagues to millions upon millions of young folks and young adults who, Derek, I don't think they would have ever thought about the Negro Leagues had we not put them in the game. And I knew they would love these players. I mean, what's not to love about the speed of Cool Papa Bell? The swagger of a Satchel Paige, the almost mythical-like power of a Josh Gibson. But the fact that they have fallen in love with the stories that I'm sharing in the game, that kind of surprised me. But even now, as I've had time to let this digest, this generation seems to, what grabs their attention is authenticity and now storytelling. Storytelling has reemerged. That's why people listen to your podcast. Yeah, they don't necessarily want to read something long form. But man, they'll sit there and listen to a podcast all day long. And we added that dimension inside the video game. And so you put a killer soundtrack and I guess a guy that tells a decent story and got them.
I don't think it's talked about enough. I'm sure you feel it. But I, you know, you and I both watched the game here for a long time, and we both have seen the annual stories about the decline in participation for black athletes. In 2020, the Cardinals, drafted three young men, black athletes, in Jordan Walker, Tink Hentz, and their shortstop, Mason Wynn. They talked about it openly. This was important to get more participation going. I think what you've done with the Negro League Museum and making it part of the mainstream conversation and putting it in the video game, I think that's going to be a force multiplier for participation. And I love the fact that it's history that is inspiring the present to play. Yes. And I think that's overlooked too much when we talk about all the elements that could go in to bring people to baseball. Here's a real tangible example of how history has inspired current play.
There is no doubt about it, because last season when the Cards came to town, and of course they'll be in town later this month to play the Royals as part of our annual salute to the Negro Leagues. And so I'm really excited about that. But last season when the Cards came to town, Jordan Walker and Victor Scott came to see me and to tour the museum. And I mean, the minute they walked in, the first thing that Jordan asked me, he wanted to know about John Donaldson.
Okay.
The great John Donaldson, who I guess in the video game, no one can hit John Donaldson. And John Donaldson, he's like, tell me about this dude, John Donaldson.
That's great.
And folks, John Donaldson was from mid-Missouri, Glasgow, Missouri, and a great left-handed pitcher who is credited with having invented the slider. And John Donaldson has over 400 verifiable wins, over 5,000 strikeouts amongst this litany of incredible jaw-dropping feats that he was responsible for. And to give you an indication of how great John Donaldson was, the legendary Leroy Satchel Paige idolized John Donaldson. He wanted to be like John Donaldson. So the things that you hear about Satchel calling the outfield in and sending the infield down, Donaldson was doing that years before Satchel ever emerged. And J.L. Wilkinson, folks, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs, swore that John Donaldson was the greatest pitcher he ever had. John Donaldson is not in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. It is a travesty, because he should. Because keep in mind that J.L. Wilkinson had Hall of Fame pitchers Wilbur Bullitt Rogan, Jose Mendez, Hilton Smith, and of course the great Leroy Satchel Paige amongst his stable of great pitchers, and he swore that John Donaldson was better than all of them. Gives you an indication of how special Donaldson was. But nobody really knew who Donaldson was until we put him in the video game. And now everybody knows, because all the kids tell me the same thing. We can't hit him. He throws his slider about 94, 95 miles.
That's going to be amazing in some Hall of Fame committee meeting when they're talking about who should go in. And one of the writers, Major Younger, is there and goes, man, have you played this guy in the video game? And everyone nods like, yeah, that's a Hall. That's so fantastic. It's just
awesome. Absolutely right. I do think that the video game, and I just think the opportunities that we've had in partnering with Major League Baseball and Major League Baseball's Players Association, part of the reason that we wanted to have this partnership is that it opened up this history. And so if you want urban kids, and particularly African-American kids, and of course, this is the Hispanic kids' story as well, but particularly as it relates to American-born Blacks, they need to see themselves. And so when they walk into this museum, or now with the video game, they see people who look just like them, who played this game as well as anyone ever played this game. But Derek, not only did they play the game, they owned teams, and they were managers and coaches, traveling secretaries, and team physicians. They fulfilled every role that could be filled in the business of baseball. And I think that's why baseball has really embraced this museum as part of the strategy to help move the needle forward as we look at African-American participation in our sport.
I think it's so great. And I love the way you put it about stories. You know, one of the things about this podcast, and one of the things I care most about, is baseball stories, and you know, I've written stories about how some of those like tall tales that used to be told around the clubhouse are diminishing as everybody looks at their phone and
raises
off and everything like that. But you know what? Maybe they're not. They're just finding a different vehicle,
different avenue, a different vehicle. And that's where the video game comes into play.
And also these special events. Rickwood is a story.
You know, I have to tip my cap to the Seattle Mariners.
Sure.
Because they're the first Major League Baseball team to ever put the Negro League uniform into their regular rotation of uniforms.
Beautiful. You know, it's a beautiful uniform.
Absolute beautiful uniform. So every Sunday home game out in Seattle, the Mariners are representing the Seattle Steelheads. The Seattle Steelheads didn't even exist for a full year in Seattle, but the Mariners have embraced how important they were as it relates to the heritage of baseball in that city. And so when the Mariners were in town here recently, J.P. Crawford brought me his game-worn Seattle Steelhead jersey so that it could be on display here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And so every time those young athletes put on those uniforms, they are actively helping us bring this story to life. And I love it. And I think they love it. All the guys from the Mariners talk about how much they enjoy wearing that uniform and understand what it represents to do so. And they're wearing the pants up high like they did in the Negro Leagues. And so, and that's why I always look forward to these in-stadium salutes to the Negro Leagues, because it just helps us grow the interest, not only in our game, but certainly in this sector of baseball and American history. And ultimately, I think it helps lead people to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Absolutely. And the Cardinals will be a part of one there in Kansas City, Bob. I mean, I could talk to you forever. I love talking to you so much. It was great to have you at the writer's dinner a few years ago so we could give you the Branch Rickey Award.
Man, that was so cool. I can't thank you guys enough. It is sitting on my credenza here in the office for everybody to see when they walk in my office.
Good. Yeah, I'm so glad you came for that. I'm a big fan of that award, and I can't think of somebody better to have given it to. So, and like I said, we could talk forever. Instead, I'm just going to urge people to go visit. Cardinal fans who make the trip to Kansas City to see the team, or just make the trip to Kansas City to see the museum there at 18th and Vine as it grows. And then everybody should go and see it after, you know, when it's new and expanded and everything. Bob, tell us again how you can help with the Pitch for the Future campaign.
Yes, please, please visit us at www.nlbm.com. And you'll see the minute you come to the website, an emblem says the legacy plays on. And that you can just hit that link and it'll take you directly to the page. You'll learn more about this incredible project that we've embarked on and how you can support it. And as I mentioned, every buck literally does count to help us reach our goal of about $50 million to build old Buck O'Neill a brand new house.
Yeah, I love it. That is Bob Kendrick, host of Black Diamonds, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, all around legendary storyteller and the keeper of so many great, important things for baseball history. Bob, thank you so much for this conversation. It's great. I hope to see you in Kansas City. Hope we cross paths again. And I know I will resolve never to go on one of your tours again without saying hello. I promise.
No, don't do that again. But Derek, thank you, man.
There are so many people there. It's great. That was great. Thank you so much, sir.
You're welcome.
I cannot thank Bob Kendrick enough. He's just a joy to talk to and such a wonderful storyteller and just an advocate for baseball history and, of course, for the museum. The Pitch for the Future campaign is well underway. You can learn more about it at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum website. Bob Kendrick is also the host of Black Diamonds, which I urge you to check out. I cannot stress enough how great it here is to hear baseball stories and Buck O'Neill stories, and as you heard here, Loop Rock stories from Bob Kendrick. He is also a winner of the Baton Branch Rickey Award, which the St. Louis Baseball Writers Chapter gives out every year for innovation and impact on baseball. Past winners have been the Clemente family, Vera Clemente, Bill James, and we gave one of the blown glass Branch Rickey trophies to the commissioner's office for the rule changes they made. It's one of the highlights of our annual dinner and one of the awards I just really treasure the chance to give. You can find information about the Baseball Writers Dinner and the Branch Rickey Award at our website for the St. Louis chapter. And you can find all of the Constant Cardinals coverage, including coverage of that dinner, at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcast. Please rate and review the podcast. I am catching up on the weekly promise, which I made, and we're getting there. We're getting there quickly with a whole bevy of episodes recorded in the past week. So look for more best podcasts in baseball. Please tell me how the 14th season is going. The best podcast in baseball brought to you weekly by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Again, thanks to Bob Kendrick for giving me all that time and giving us all that insight and really inspiration. For the best podcast in baseball, I'm baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon.